Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. At first thought, haute French cuisine and Southern cooking might have very little in common. But a closer look into the kitchen and the cooking techniques involved prove otherwise. My guest today has adapted the best French cooking techniques and applies them to traditional Southern recipes and staples. Chef Jennifer Hill Booker was born in Michigan, but grew up in the deep south of Florida, and spent summers and holidays at the family farm in the Mississippi Delta. She graduated from the University of Tulsa before attending the culinary arts program at OSU's Institute of Technology. From there, her training took her to Europe and eventually to Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. Today, she's the executive chef of Your Resident Gourmet, a personal chef and catering company in Atlanta, Georgia, and is an instructor at the Le Cordon Bleu College of Culinary Arts in Atlanta. She's contributed to a variety of magazines, including Vegetarian Times, and is an adherent of the farm-to-table movement. She's just published her first cookbook. It's out, Field Peas du Foie Gras, Southern Recipes with a French Accent. It's published by Pelican. In it, she provides a complete look at Southern food, from breakfast foods and desserts to vegetables, breads, and pork and chicken dishes. Traditional Southern staples like cracklin' bread, fried chicken, and buttermilk biscuits contrast with things like winter pumpkin soup or fig-stuffed chicken livers. Along the way, there are little sidebars which explore some of the ins and outs of this melding of Southern and French cuisine. Chef Booker returns to Tulsa this weekend. She'll be signing her book tomorrow afternoon from 2 to 4 at the Barnes & Noble on 71st Street. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Jennifer Hill Booker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This first cookbook is out, Field Peas du Foie Gras, in which you take, it reflects on both of your experience as a child of the South growing up with Southern cooking,
yes.
A cooking instructor who went to OSU Tech.
Yes.
And then over to Europe and to Le Cordon Bleu, you adapted the French techniques.
Yes.
And this book, which it's really a Southern cookbook, but you've taken the best parts of French cuisine and adapted it to what works for Southern cooking.
I agree with you with that, and I found that the two cuisines marry beautifully. A lot of the same cooking techniques, ingredients, attention to detail. And then, of course, in the South, we like to cook seasonally, as do the French, and present a beautiful table.
Mm. And, you know, when you think about it, with the two cuisines, you think of nothing further dissimilar. But when you actually think about the techniques,
yes.
Braising,
yes.
Slow cooking, using every bit of the animal,
yes.
if it's a meat dish.
Exactly.
There's all sorts of ways in which the techniques are similar. Now, you sort of, in your introduction, you talk about going to Le Cordon Bleu and how you felt like there was going to be prejudice because you were from the South,
right.
Instead of French. He says, really, the prejudice was because you were a woman.
Isn't that interesting? Yes. The prejudice was I was a female, and cooking, no matter what they tell you, is still a very male-dominated job. So you have to kind of, as a woman, push your way in and be fearless. There were many times that I would go into the locker room or the ladies' room and cry. You know, I could never let anyone see that, but, yeah, you know, it was tough. But I enjoyed the rigor of the course. The instructors, all of the techniques I learned and the food and their approach to cuisine. So it was worth it, for sure.
Yeah. Well, in this book, you have a lot of great Southern favorites, things like fried chicken,
mm-hmm.
Pork shoulder, you know, all sorts of things, biscuits,
yes.
buttermilk biscuits. But you also have a lot of the foods that I would call them the foods of poverty, but they're
right.
Rich for the soul. You know, everything from chicken feet to
hominy.
Yeah, hominy. Yeah. But you begin the book with a description of something that I knew about growing up. I never did as an adult.
Okay.
And probably a whole generation of people here in Oklahoma also grew up with it and have also discarded that technique, which is canning and preserving. And this has become a lost art in about a generation here in our part of the world.
I agree. And I grew up watching my grandmother and mother and great aunts do canning and preserving. And that was just part of the fall harvest or the late summer harvest. And I enjoy it. And because I'm, you know, a foodie at heart, I don't like to waste anything. So if I can get a fresh product and keep it for later and know that in December I can open up a jar of strawberry preserves that remind me of, you know, the spring, then I love to do that. But you're absolutely right. I have so many people that come up to me and say, oh, my grandmother used to can, or I used to help my aunt, and I don't know how to do it, and I've forgotten. And I love that you have easy-to-follow techniques in your cookbook.
Yeah, and that's the way you begin the book, mm-hmm. actually. Why was it just because of the fact that when you say, I can, people go, don't even know how to do that
anymore. Well, it was one of the favorite things that I enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. I felt it was something people could relate to because most everyone has a food memory of someone in their family canning and preserving or maybe opening up a can of something or a jar of something that was gifted to them. So it grabs the reader and it makes them feel at home and allows them to kind of get lost in the stories of the cookbook.
Now, let me ask you, whether you're canning green beans or making preserves,
yes.
You know, there's the hope that it's going to taste just as good as fresh. about March or
right.
February, you
right.
open it up and it's got, oh, I just might as well got a Del Monte.
Oh, no.
You know, there's not much difference. Right. Are there any secrets to making your canning products as good or as close to fresh as you can?
Well, the main key is to use the freshest, most pristine item. So you want the best green beans, no bruises, no breaks. Minimal cooking, meaning you don't boil them to death and then put them in the jar and then process the jar. So as fresh as you can get them in the jar, a little salt or, you know, baking soda or acid like lemon always helps. And then the processing is what seals it airtight. And you should have a nice, fresh, crisp jar of green beans that do not taste like Del Monte.
Now, you also go through pickling process. That's
yes.
another lost art that people yes. just go buy a jar of pickles rather than taking a cucumber and doing it themselves.
I think a lot of it is we were so amazed with ready-to-eat foods that we forgot our history and our heritage. And a lot of people are coming back to see that that's very quick and easy to do. It's definitely economical. And it's that joy of making something yourself that you're enjoying and sharing with your family. So I tell everyone, hey, give it a try. Super easy. You don't have to put up 17 bushels of cucumbers. You can do, you know, 3 or 4. It's okay. Just get back into that lost art.
Yeah, when you said quick and easy, I was thinking my childhood where it was like a whole afternoon of
yes.
sterilizing bottles.
Right.
And it didn't seem quick and easy.
No, nowadays, you can just run it through your dishwasher cycle and your jars are ready to go. So.
Yeah. Well, in that first section, you have some recipes for some vinaigrettes and things mm-hmm. like that and pickling. And then a great recipe, which is called green tomato cha-cha, you
yes,
call it, or
yes.
chow-chow.
Uh-huh.
And you said this comes from France. You've been making it in the South and you didn't realize it.
And I did realize it. And it took living in Paris and studying at Le Cordon Bleu to find that a lot of the things I grew up eating that they were cooking there as well. But then I had that aha moment where, okay, the French were in the Americas when we were first founding the Americas, and they taught a lot of the slaves who cooked the foods, you know, in the new Americas, how to cook. So it makes perfect sense that there's something we eat here in the South that they eat there in France and in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Any differences between the two?
I think, I know, at least for my recipe, I like a little more cabbage, just a little more rustic or coarse. Mm-hmm. And is not as refined as some I've had when I was in Paris.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the similarities between the cooking. What are the big differences? Is it in the spices used?
Definitely, I found to be in the spices. They being the French, like a lot of, say, tarragon or fennel or anise, a lot of the black licorice flavors mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That we don't do so much here in the South.
Are there some of the spice sort of textures, if you will, that do adapt to Southern dishes pretty
definitely
well?
Definitely fresh thyme works beautifully. Mm-hmm. Even lavender you can add to the dishes.
I know
dishes.
There's a number of mm-hmm. lavender dishes in yeah. this where you've adapted that.
Yes.
And is lavender not usually used in the Southern kitchen? I wouldn't think
no,
so.
No, it isn't. You think more like sachets or, you know, potpourri. But it adds a nice freshness, and that fragrance translates to taste when you add a little in your seasoning or in a cake or lemonade.
Yeah. Now, the next section of the book deals with garden vegetable dishes and lots of garden vegetable dishes. And one of the things I love of this book, it has all these little sidebars, like the beginning section on canning. But you mentioned hominy early, and there's this little section on making hominy. I love hominy, but I only eat hominy out of a can. Now, what am I missing not making fresh hominy?
Well, I think you're okay, maybe, in this situation. It is a process, and I would watch my grandmother make it, and you have, you know, your fresh corn, and you have your lye, which is your ash from your fire, that you mix in that causes the process of the corn swelling up and popping out of its skin. So what I liked with the sidebars and what I will try to translate was some history. So you have a little nugget of information that either reminds you of a childhood memory or something fresh and new that you're learning to do. And in the case of hominy, you definitely can make your own. If you have all the ingredients, or
I'm getting the sense you would just rather buy it in a can.
Well, I'm not a hominy fan, so maybe I'm a little prejudiced on this particular topic. But I think watching my grandmother, it was just such a bizarre chemical reaction that I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to eat something that I watch, you know, swell up and pop out of its skin.
Right, and they're picking ash.
There you go.
Well, there are some really interesting recipes. Watermelon, a staple of Southern summer and out of the garden. But you have this wonderful dish called a watermelon salad with an apple cider vinaigrette, which you also describe how to make.
Right.
What does that do to what does that vinaigrette do to the watermelon?
The vinaigrette, because you have that nice acid, it brings out the sweetness of the watermelon. So you've taken something that is very pedestrian, you know, a southern watermelon, and you elevate it so that it's just the meat of the melon, no rinds. You have a little sweetness from your cider vinegar. Cider vinegar is a staple of the South. So it's just combining items that naturally go together to make a more elegant dish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's still watermelon.
Yeah. And when you're talking about vegetables, you said this is one of the things you took away from the French experience is that in the South, we love to cook those vegetables.
Oh, yes.
Until they're just falling apart.
Oh, yes.
And he says, you know, cook them a little less.
A little less. And it's okay. You still have, you know, the nutrients, a bright color. It's better for you. And it really does taste good. And I know, for example, my mother is a convert. She was a little guilty of cooking it till it was dead. And she's kind of backed off that a bit. And now they're greener and crisper and fresher. And she found she likes it.
You said cutting vegetables into uniform pieces, again, aids that shorter cooking time.
Right, shorter cooking method.
Adds a lot of flavor. And that's another French technique.
Yes, which it looks better. It's more aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah. Now, there's one other dish which struck me as, I don't know, maybe more French than Southern, wild mushroom ragu. Did you grow up eating wild mushrooms?
I did not, and that's definitely a takeaway from the French cuisines. But I have met a lot of Georgians who go mushroom hunting and gathering, and so they'll bring it in, and they said, hey, I've used your recipe when we got back from foraging for mushrooms. So it is definitely a French recipe, but I'm finding that the Southerners love it as well.
Now, beans and greens.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that sounds Southern.
Oh,
but
for sure.
You said when you got to France, it's French, too.
Yeah, I went to the farmer's market, and they had purple hull peas, which I used to shell by the bushel when I was a kid. And so I was just so thrilled to see something that I recognize I grew up with. And I bought, you know, a double handful and just cooked a small amount for myself. So they eat tons of greens, raw and cooked, and the beans as well.
Yeah. My guest today is Jennifer Hill Booker. She teaches at Le Cordon Bleu College of Culinary Arts in Georgia. She also has a catering business, and she has her first cookbook. She's a graduate of OSU Tech.
Yes.
I guess that was the first time you really stepped into a commercial kitchen, I guess.
It was. I got my undergrad here at University of Tulsa and then went on to OSU Tech. And it was my first commercial kitchen and learned classical French cuisine. We had a European instructor. So that was my first taste of that cuisine.
And her book is titled Field Peas to Foie Gras, Southern Recipes with a French Accent. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Yes. Well, did that training prepare you for?
Oh, definitely. I tell anyone that will listen, a technical education is a wonderful foundation for any career path that you decide. And for me, I learned more about cooking, I would say the fundamentals of cooking, than I did when I was at Le Cordon Bleu in Paris.
Yeah.
So it definitely prepared me.
Now, you relate a few stories as you're relating recipes from Le Cordon Bleu, and it's like one day you show up and there's a rabbit in front of you. And
oh,
it's
yeah.
Like, and you go, rabbit, well, I've cooked squirrels.
Yeah.
And so I just adapted the same way.
Yep,
did that put you in good stead?
It did, because some of the other students were, you know, were screaming, because when we say rabbit, I'm not talking about bunny foo-foo. I'm talking about, you know, this snarling rabbit with the head and the paws and the claws, you know, so you didn't want to pet it. But yeah, I felt very confident, because we grew up eating both squirrel and rabbit. My grandfather was a hunter. So I jumped right in and felt pretty good about it.
There was another story you told. It says, you know, when you were looking at the dessert part of the training, you had all sorts of fruit dishes and galettes and all sorts of things. We didn't talk about cobbler at all. So I went and made a peach cobbler and took it to your instructor. What was the reaction from him?
It's interesting, because he was very surprised, because it was so different than the very fine pastries that you find in France. But, you know, good food translates. So you have a nice crust. You have the sweet and the spices of the fruit. The fruit was nice and firm. So he loved it. And he was very excited that I was able to take their recipe, quote unquote, and turn it into a cobbler, another recipe. Yes.
It is the center of the world, isn't
well,
it?
Well, there you go.
One of the interesting things about your book, and you said this is something that the Southern cuisine and French cuisine have in common, is that you really don't waste any part of a butchered animal.
Correct.
You know, it's everything from the, you know, oxtail soup on up to the head.
Right.
And you have a number of recipes that probably a lot of folks have not ever tried, or maybe had it in a restaurant once.
Okay.
But things like oxtail soup. Now, that's something you might see in a restaurant. But things like chicken feet.
Right.
Or hogshead cheese. Yeah. Or pig ear or pig tail. Or gizzards.
Right.
I love gizzards, by the way.
I did, too.
And, of course, rabbit and squirrel. Right. You have several recipes for those. What are we missing by not going for some of those dishes that feature the entire animal?
Oh, taste. Yeah. Flavor and texture, because a lot of those byproducts of the, you know, the main animal have so much intense flavor. They have, you know, the gelatinous sauces, so those thick gravies, and a real intense flavor. Also, we have to, or at least I always think, economics. So they're inexpensive. There's something that translates from a stew or a soup, fried or braised or boiled. So it's very versatile.
Now, if you're going to try one of those, which one would you try?
I say if you're feeling very adventurous, I would go for the chicken feet. Personally, I like chicken feet. If you're not feeling so adventurous, maybe you can go with the oxtails.
Okay, the chicken feet, I want to really like it, but they still look like chicken feet.
They do look like chicken feet. You can't dress them up. They're still chicken feet.
But what sort of, I mean, I would assume it's kind of like the cartilage that you're eating on a fried chicken or something like
it
that?
It is, but stewed down, braised down, so it becomes very soft. Think of grown-up Jell-O. That might not be a great analogy. But instead of strawberry, it has flavors of garlic and onion and chicken and pepper, and you can eat it over rice, and it's just rich. And I'm getting excited here because I love it. And it's just very rich and silky, so I say try it.
Yeah. The book has all sorts of sections and lots of sidebar techniques. We've talked about a little bit about the making hominy, but a couple of them, again, these are lost arts, if you will. Well, I shouldn't say washing greens, because there's a huge community that do still do the greens.
Sure.
But, you know, you kind of talk in the various techniques. And so you were a family that washed them, what, 4 or 5 times?
Yeah, to get, because we pulled them directly out of the garden. So you had to get all the dirt
and sand.
Even in
the store, there's still a lot of dirt on the
green. Oh, yeah, for sure. So that was our technique. And then I have a really good girlfriend that I was visiting for a holiday, and we're talking in the kitchen, and she's, you know, washing the greens, and I see her squirt in some dish liquid. And I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, you don't wash your greens with dish liquid? I'm like, no. She's like, oh, every woman in my family, that's how we wash them. And so asking around, I find some people wash it with dish liquid. People have put it in the washing machine and put it just on a rinse cycle to get all the dirt and kind of tenderize it. I've seen people or heard people say they wash it in the bathtub to, you know, if they're doing a lot. So, hey, I'm not here to judge. Everyone has their technique.
But also things like seasoning and cleaning a cast iron skillet.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of come back, the cast iron skillet. Yes. It kind of went away for a long time. Right. You could buy them for $2 at a junk store. Now
it's back in vogue. Yeah, absolutely. And I have pieces from my mother and from my grandmother. I've gotten into arguments with my sisters over who's getting what pan. I was at a thrift store, and there was a set of two, and I grabbed it, and another lady grabs my hand. And I'm looking at her, and she said, well, we'll split it. You pay $5, and I'll pay $5. And she was dead serious. So, yeah. So, needless to say, I let her pay her $5.
Now, do cast iron skillets have some, each one of them, is it a little bit of a different personality how they cook?
I think so. It depends on how heavy they are. You definitely want to season them, meaning you rub them with oil and allow that to kind of slowly cook and seep into the iron.
And the more you season it, the better it
cooks. At a certain point, I have a couple pieces that I don't have to use any oil in the pan when I cook even a fried egg.
Yeah. Well, there's some really great recipes in this. The hog is a big connection between Southern cooking.
Oh, yes.
And this becomes very apparent. Again, it's going back to the fact that you're using everything from the hog's head to pig's feet.
Yes, exactly.
And it pig's feet as a gourmet dish.
Yes.
It can be. Yeah,
it can be. You can even say cut it at the shank and take the bones out and stuff it with like a ground sausage and then roast it that way. So it elevates something that we think of as a throwaway, cut of meat.
Now, a lot of these recipes, as you're telling us about the recipes, you'll say, my mother. I'd like to meet your mother. Yes. I'd like to have dinner. But how many of these recipes, or at least the basis of them, comes from your mother's recipes?
I would say 70% of them.
70%.
And she's a wonderful cook, still is. And her experience growing up was in Michigan, so she ate a lot of ethnic foods. So we grew up eating a lot of ethnic foods, as well as Southern cuisine. And that's where I gained my appreciation for food, was from her.
And so might be one day, might be like something from like some of the Eastern European traditions, and then the next day it's out of Southern Georgia.
One day we may have Rubens and potato salad. The next we may have a Hungarian goulash. The third we may have fried chicken.
Now, was she adventurous about learning how to cook it as a Hungarian goulash, as opposed to what most Americans call goulash?
Definitely. We had a lot of diverse friends, so they would trade recipes. And that was always cool, and I thought that was the norm when I, growing up. And then I meet people that have never cooked anything different from what they, ate day to day, which may only be Hungarian or Southern or Vietnamese. So,
yeah. I have to tell you, the bread section, that's where I saw your mother's, my mother or my grandmother's recipe from buttermilk biscuits. But I have to ask about the butter roll, which is, I think I've had it, and we call it spoon bread.
Okay.
Is that
another? Similar, the spoon bread I've had have always been cornmeal based, like a corn pudding.
Right.
But this was a dish that my grandmother would make for breakfast. And so if she didn't do biscuits, she would take a yeast dough and spread it with sugar and butter, and then bake it with sweet milk, she called it. So milk that's sweetened with sugar. And we would just eat it in lieu of bread for breakfast.
Yeah, and you would spoon it out.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. So we're probably talking about the exact same dish.
Yeah, another one I'd never heard of before, hoe cakes.
Oh, you never heard of a hoe cake?
I never have heard of a hoe cake.
Okay.
I guess I've been deprived.
You have been deprived. One of my favorite breads, and it's cornmeal, it's like cornbread, Mm-hmm. And I like unsweetened cornbread. And
but it almost cakes. Looks like a pancake.
Yeah, it is. You cook it.
It's a
similar.
Corn pancake.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And cook it in a little lard or rendered bacon or butter. And it crisps up, so you have the crisp edges, and it's delicious.
Now, the story you tell of how mm-hmm. It got its name
right.
goes back to slavery days.
Exactly, and it was called a hoe cake because it was literally cooked on a hoe that was heated in the fire when slaves were allowed to take a break to eat. And so not having pots or pans, they would heat that metal piece on the hoe and then cook their cornmeal mush on that. And so then that's how they got the hoe cakes.
Mm. Well, there's another dish that I do want to try. And it's
okay.
another breakfast dish, and it's an omelet.
Oh,
but
yes.
But it's a different kind of omelet.
The spring roll.
The spring
yes.
omelet roll.
Yes.
Now, this was, a family recipe?
Well, this was when I modified myself and just trying to find a brunch recipe that looked a little more festive.
Mm-hmm.
And a little more elegant. So it's really an omelet that you bake in a jelly roll pan, and you roll it up, and then you're able to slice it. So it gives you just more visually appealing.
And it looks like it has the texture of a souffle in a lot of ways.
Yes, it is lighter. It mm-hmm. is lighter than perhaps just a traditional omelet.
And so what do you fill it with?
Whatever you like.
Mm-hmm.
This one in the recipe has like a Dijon mustard, ham and tomato and cheese, so it is savory. But if you like sausage, if you like mushrooms, if you only want cheese, it's really versatile. It's up to you.
Yeah, spring yeah. omelet roll.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Well, what's the recipe that's gotten the most reaction in this book, you think?
There are a couple. For example, the chicken feet, people are like, whoa.
Just from the novelty.
Just for the novelty. black-eyed pea salad. I was yeah. really surprised about how many people love that recipe and made it and are so excited. So I'm thinking, it's black-eyed peas. What's the big deal? But I guess, you know, having it in a different variation gets people excited, something they recognize and they feel comfortable with.
Black-eyed peas is probably one of those dishes that people just don't know how to make them.
I think you might be right.
And I think there's an off-putting... And I have to be honest, I'm one of those that the sort of briny slime that it comes out of when it comes out of a can,
mm-hmm. right.
that takes some getting over.
Yeah, I could see that. But it's so easy. And once again, that apple cider, it just brings out the sweetness of the black-eyed peas. When I was a kid, I always thought they taste like dirt. So I was not a fan. And as I've gotten older and a little more sophisticated, I like that earthy. Now it's not dirt, it's earthy, that earthy flavor. And then with the vinaigrette and the fresh herbs and the onion and peppers, it's really a great dish.
Well, the name of the book is Field Peas to Foie Gras, Southern Recipes with a French Accent. Jennifer Hill Booker, welcome back to Oklahoma.
We're
happy to have you, and thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
Chef Jennifer Hill Booker speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She is the executive chef of Your Resident Gourmet in Atlanta, Georgia. She returns to Tulsa with her new cookbook, her first book, Field Peas to Foie Gras, Southern Recipes with a French Accent. She'll be signing the book tomorrow from 2 to 4 at Barnes & Noble on 71st Street. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.